My mother was up for a state office in the Rebecca Lodge. And they asked her to step down because of something one of her children were doing. Of course, they're talking about me. Mother said to me, "Would you please not come over here? I don't want people seeing you coming out of the house. I don't want our neighbors knowing about all this. I'm just tired of it. If anybody asks if you're our daughter, would you tell them no?" I said, "Sure, Mama, I will." I understood. She was just in such pain. And so I stayed away. I stayed away for a long time in my house. My dad would sneak around and come see me and the baby. And it was several years before I was back in my mother's graces, and it was because I came into this fellowship. She saw I was trying. I went over one day at my sponsor's insistence after that fifth step, because I certainly didn't want to go over there. And I made amends to them, told them I was wrong and how bad it all was. And I had heard a man around this particular time who had, it was later. But anyway, this man said, when we make amends, we go to them and we tell them what we know that we've harmed them. And then he said, then when we get through with that, we say to them, "Now I know this is what I remembered that I did that harmed you. And I know there's many things that I did that I'm not aware of. If you will tell me that now, I'll try to clean it up." And he said, "You just have to sit there and listen to what they tell you. You do not defend it." Years later, I went back with my mother and said this because I'd heard it again. "So, Mom, what are the things that I did that I'm not aware of?" And she was told me some of these things. And then he said, "When they get through, you say, 'I agree, that must really hurt. What can I do to make this right? I'm willing to do anything that you ask of me.'" Now, that's scary. And I did that with my mom and with my dad, too. And, of course, those people forgave me. And little by little by little, they forgave me. And then it was like, I was told, "You have to go over there 10 minutes every week." And I'd go over there for 10 minutes. It was a hard 10 minutes because my mother would not. She would just turn her back. And my dad would be as gracious as he could be. I'd take the kids. And then I'd go stay 15 minutes and just kept on doing that until finally I didn't show up 1 week. And she called me and asked me where I was. And then we slowly got back together with this stuff. My daughter, when she first got sober, what was it, 14, 15 years ago, whenever it was, she got one of my tapes and listened to it. She was so excited about it, she sent it to my mother. Mother listened till it stopped. She didn't know you were supposed to turn it over. So she heard the first half. And she wrote me a letter. She didn't even call me. She wrote me a letter, and she said, "Don't you remember that I did love you? Don't you remember that time when you was 8 years old and I made you that dress, that little brown and white jet dress for Easter? Don't you remember the time that we gave you your grandmother's car?" This is what she was trying to tell me, how she loved me. She made me a dress and she gave me a car. And that was the best my mom could do. And I called her. I said, "Mom, turn the tape over. Turn the tape over." I worked as hard as I could on that relationship with my mother. My mother accepted me and loved me, but my mother never liked me. And I often wondered what it was, what I did. It was just incredible. She just didn't like me. It was showed. A couple of years ago when she was getting sick and it was obviously getting to the end of her life, she started calling me and telling me things that were incredible about regrets, about a lifestyle. That's when I discovered that she was a child of an alcoholic. It had never been mentioned in all those years. Then you got to talking about my grandmother. Three of her husbands, ex-husbands, my grandmother, and we're talking about, 20s and 30s, that did not get divorced. She did. She had three drunk husbands. No wonder, you know. And we discussed that stuff. So I was flying home. And on the plane, I said, "God, mother's, she's going to die pretty soon. If you could you let me know why my mother doesn't like me? I mean, I'm settled. My heart's okay with it, but I'm really just kind of curious. Why didn't you like me?" I was home that week. My brother came up with his two kids. My niece is pregnant. I mean, pregnant. So I said, "Christy, when's that baby due?" And she said, "Well, next week, but if I don't go into labor by Friday, they told me to come in. They're going to induce labor." My mother come up out of her chair. She got this twisted look on her face. She said, "Christy, don't let them do that to you. They induced labor on me with Fenoy, and it was the most painful thing I ever went through in my life. I never forgot it." I caused my mother so much pain at birth, she never forgave me. This is an Al-Anon unforgiveness thing, untreated Al-Anon. And it was like, oh, is that all it was? Thank you, God. If that's all it was, I had no part of that. That was none of my being. Thank you for giving me that bit of information. It was a healing thing for me. When my mother was very sick those last few days, these Rebeccas started showing up at the hospital. They were bringing food for us, for me and my brothers. And they were helping us, and they were delivering this and picking this up, and on and on and on. When she died, they asked if they could do the Rebecca thing. I don't know if it's Oddfellows Rebecca, some of you know that. So they came, we had a graveside service there, and they came, and they all had their little scrolls, and they read all this stuff, and it was really nice. The other thing that they do is they drape the charter, and they have to wait. Their bylaws say they have to wait a month, and then they have this incredible little service, and they put this black veil over the charter, and it stays there for so many months for the person who just passed away. And they called me, and I told you we were trying to get all this house torn down in 2 weeks, and they called and they said, we know you have to get back to California, so for you we would like to change our bylaws. We've had a meeting, and we will do that. If you can come next Thursday, we will go ahead and drape the charter. And I cannot tell you the healing amend that did for me. And I went, and they all had on their gowns some of them put them together in 1920, and you could tell that they were 1920. And some of them had little crowns, and they were little princesses. And it was so meaningful to me. And it was like, this is the result of the amends. These people it was all put back together. My mother, as far as I'm concerned, gave me a message. It's okay. I like you. It was okay. It was all full circle. And God put that together. My brother, who committed suicide, he did not speak to me for 26 years. He did not let his children speak to me. I was not welcome in his home. There was nothing, absolutely nothing between us. He had a boy and a girl, Tanya and Butch, about the same ages as my two kids. I have a daughter and that son. I had a child out of wedlock and gave it up for adoption. And then I came straight home from that and got pregnant again with my daughter and kept her. And my brother said he could forgive me for one thing, but to turn around and do it again, he could not forgive. And he just would not, he just marked me off. I was totally unwanted in his life. Then as time passed, I realized he was an alcoholic. Now, this was, of course, my favorite brother, and he had helped raise me. When my brother was hurt and my parents were gone for so long, this brother took care of me. He gave me my spending money. He helped me learn things. He gave me books to go to school, all those things, and he was like almost a dad to me. And him not speaking to me was very painful for a long time. In my head, someday he'll make amends to me, and we'll get it all put back together, and it's going to be great. It will be wonderful. I still had that hope just floating around. You know, I just knew it was going to be. And I got the call that he'd killed himself. And my first thought was, God, he never forgave me. We never got it right. I'm just so sorry. And I was talking about that, and my friend Dick Martin came to me, and he said, you know what? Your brother did make amends to you. He took himself out when he knew he could not stop hurting. Shortly thereafter, both my girls have been very instrumental in his kids getting sober. Very instrumental. I thought, if you could just see this, brother dear. My kids, the ones that you would not have anything to do with, and that child that was born out of wedlock, just 12-stepped your daughter. And your daughter's going to be all right. Now, she's been in and out and in and out. Sober again, last I heard. I got a note from her. She's sober again, but she's been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous the last 14 years. And I bet part of this is the reason. She had two children out of wedlock, and he quit speaking to her. And just a few weeks before his death, she went to a dock where he was living on a houseboat. And she went to him, and she'd been in AA for a little while, and she said, "Dad," he looked up. There was like several people on his boat, and he looked up, and he says, "What do you want?" And she had her oldest daughter, and she said, "Well," she just wanted to see her granddad, and I thought you might like to meet her, and I need to tell you that I'm really sorry for all the things I've done that's hurt you." And he said, "You know what, it's just too late." And he turned his back on her and never spoke to his granddaughter. He got that one glimpse of her, and he never spoke to her. And then shortly thereafter, he killed himself. And I thought, man, this is, the disease is so nasty. It is so nasty. And when Dick told me that this was going to be all right, that things were going to be okay, and this young girl is going to be all right eventually, Butch got sober. I met him at a convention, and it was right after the anniversary of my brother's death. It was like the second one, I think. And he said, "I've got something I want to give you." He said, "I went through Dad's billfold. Now, my nephew looks exactly, I'm talking exactly like his dad. It's spooky." And he said, "I went through Dad's billfold and I found this, and I think this needs to belong to you. I recognized what it is." And what it was a Al-Anon bookmark. And it was folded over to the St. Francis Prayer. Now, St. Francis Prayer is the most meaningful prayer in my life. I have St. Francis's everywhere. It changed my life. And any time I'm in trouble, I go to that prayer. And it was, and I just started shaking, and I looked up, and there was a smile on my nephew's face that I swear it was spooky. It's like my brother. And at that moment, I knew I was forgiven by my brother. I don't know how he had that in his billfold. I don't know why he had that in his billfold. But it was in his billfold, and it was presented to me on the day and time that I needed it. I think a full circle. I think God used him and did that. My ex-husband. I told him once that I was sorry, but, you know, I was wrong. And when someone's drinking, they don't accept it, don't realize it. Sometimes you just have to take an action. Whether they hear it or whether they don't hear it, you just have to take an action. 3.5 years ago, or maybe it's 4 now, I can't even remember, my son called me, and he said, "They just called me about Dad. He's in the hospital. He stuck his arm in some machinery and almost ripped it off, and he almost bled to death, and he's in the hospital. He's really bad shape." Now, my son and his dad have been close all these years. I have not been able to be much a part of my son's life when he's growing up years because of his dad. He lived with him all that time. And he constantly told my son that we were not together because of Al-Anon, because of AA. That it was their fault, their fault, their fault. So my son's had a real negative thing about all of it. And he said, My ex-husband had gotten, his drinking had progressed. This is 26 years later since I left him. 26 years he was still drinking and drinking and drinking. He had wound up on a cot in the back of this warehouse, and this man was letting him live there on this cot for doing a little handiwork around the place. And he kept himself in whiskey, and that's about all he had all the time. So my son called and told me about this, and I said, "Son, it's time to commit your daddy." He said, "I know it, Mother," and he started crying. He said, "But I can't do it. Daddy will never speak to me again if I do that." I said, "I can do it." And I went to my husband, Jim, and I told him what was going on, and he said, and Tracy was, I think, 5 months sober from her 10-year, I think she's 5 months sober at the time, and Jim said, "Let me buy Tracy a ticket and send her back and let her talk with her dad." And he did. My husband gave my daughter a ticket, and she went back and talked to her dad. Told him a little bit about her. This is the man who had, not her real father, this is her stepfather. And he had raised her, and she feels like he's a dad. And she told him about her alcoholism and what it done to her, and he just said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And she left to go get a cup of coffee. Now, she left, this is in Lubbock, Texas. She left the hospital and went to the Hub of the Plains group where she went and got sober. It was in the afternoon, it was about 6:30. She goes there and sits down, and in a minute in walks this guy named Sonny. And he sits down and says, "Well, Tracy, what are you doing here?" And she told him what had happened. He said, "Well, come on, let's go. I'm going to go talk to your dad." And he said to her on the way to the hospital, he said, "You know, I just got in from work. I took a shower. I put my jammies on. I ate a little supper, and I was watching TV. And he said, I was so restless, I could not sit here." He said, I knew I had to get dressed, go down to the club and get a cup of coffee. He went in and sat down first place, and he's the person he saw was Tracy, and then he knew why he was restless. They went up. He talked to my ex-husband, 12-stepped him. They put him in the VA hospital, and my husband's sober today. Full circle. It was all of us trying to make amends to this man, and it happened. It happened. It is so absolutely incredible. It just astounds me. I made amends to both of my children the best I could. The best I could say to them, and they've forgiven me as much as they could. I mean, as much as they could. Anytime I miss the mark, God's going to come around and give me another chance. If I ever miss the mark, He's going to give me this time and this time and this time and this time because I'm worth it. Because those amends set me right. My head's held up and I'm getting visible. As hard as they are difficult amends. Very difficult. My mother worked for this company years ago, and I went down there one Sunday. It was like a wholesale house. And my brother worked there, and my brother left his watch. He said, would you go down there and pick that watch Sunday afternoon? I said, sure, and it's a warehouse district. I go down there, and there's nobody around there, and I have the key. And I opened this door and found this little watch, then I opened up this door, and there was the warehouse. Now, the warehouse had anything you could imagine. Go down to Foley's and open the door, and that's like what this was. And I thought, I was in a pickup. And when I left there, that pickup was full. The bed was full. That was many years before I got in the program. And I was in the program about 6 or 7 years before this came to light, and I said, called my sponsor, and she met me. I said, I don't know about this one. They'll throw me in jail. She said, well, if they do, they just do. And by this time, I was divorced, and I was divorced, and so I went and made an appointment with this man, the owner of it, and went in, and he knew my brother well, and talked to him and told him what I'd done, and he was so fascinated. I was coming telling him like 12, 13 years later, and he would keep getting back to what I was there for. And finally, I said, I need to make amends. Please don't throw me in jail. I don't know how much. I'll tell you what I got, what I stole, what I can do with it. And finally, he said, you know what? We put that within our price range. We have to, because employees steal us blind anyway. So it's in our prices. Y'all didn't know that, but every time you go to Foley's, you pay for somebody stealing something from them. He said, it's okay. And I said, well, how about if I make a donation to a church in your name? He said, no. If you need to make a donation to get yourself off the hook, go make it to your church. I don't need it. And I left there, and I was just shaking. And it was like, this is not right. Something's supposed to be right. You're supposed to pay for your amend. There's trouble there. And I drove a couple blocks. I just had to pull over. I was really shaking. And as I sat there, it dawned on me, this voice that sometimes hits your head. This is what they say when they say you've received the grace of God. I didn't have to do anything except say I was wrong. And I got God's grace from that. What an incredible thing. Making amends has been one of the biggest turnarounds in my life. I've learned to forgive, and there's been a few who's even made amends to me. I'm still waiting on some, too. That ex-husband hadn't knocked on my door yet. It's made me transparent. It's got me forgiveness, and it's been incredible. These books will tell you how to do it. Step 10. Is awesome. Step 10 is awesome. Out of the AA's 12 and 12. A few years ago, Jim and I, my sponsor says that people have, she read this somewhere in some book, people have personalities. Either you're a skunk or a turtle. A skunk personality, if you upset them, if they get mad, they spew, and everybody runs and hides from them, and they're very unpleasant. If a turtle gets upset, it withdraws. You can't get them out of that shell. You can hammer it. You can bang on it. You can do whatever you need to do, but you are not going to get them out of that shell. She says, normally, a skunk marries a turtle. Every one of you right now knowing what you are. Some of you are skirtles.
Jim and I were both skunks, and there's no doubt in anybody's mind. We were both skunks. We were both very passionate people. We're very intense people, and we're both directors and controllers, and we both know best, and we just plowed through life, me and him. And we could clear a room in about 10 seconds. We'd just clear a room. You know, me trying to tell him what to do and him trying to tell what me to do. Pretty soon he's screaming and I'm screaming and they're saying, excuse me, I got to go see about, you know, and they're gone. And it got worse and worse and heavier and heavier. And we got to the point where we were living here in Dallas, and Jim was really rich when I first married him. I married him and he was rich. And let me tell you, I loved being rich. It was incredible. And that lasted for about 30 minutes. We were in the oil business and real estate business in Oklahoma in 1982. Yeah, the oil bust. And so we lost everything. So we moved over here to Dallas, and we were here for a few years and trying to put something back together. And he had gone. Clancy was his sponsor all. My husband, when he died, had 30 years of sobriety. Clancy was his sponsor all that time, and he'd gone out to celebrate Clancy's birthday. And Clancy said to him, you know, Jim, you've done... not done well back there. Why don't you come on back here? Because he was out there for 17 years, I guess, when we got married, something like that. Sober out there. He said, why don't you come on back here and put your life back together? So we did. We moved to California. We moved out there, and he was beginning to put his business together, and then his brother died, and then my brother committed suicide, and all this stuff started happening, and it was just like heaviness. He was grieving over his brother. I was grieving over my brother. The business wasn't going good. You know, all the major things they tell you. If a move or a death or financial, all these major things make it really hard for you. And we were going through several. So we were not getting along very well at all. And to the point where I said to him one day, you know, I've had it. I'm going back to Texas. He said, okay. I called my sponsor. She said, no, I don't think you're going to do that today. She said, you know, when you made those vows, it was not to Jim Shaw. You made those vows to God Almighty, and you're going to respect those vows. You just stay right there right now and let's do some work. And so I was doing some work and he was doing some work, and things were, it was really amazing, was coming back together. And just as we was kind of coming back together, they called me from Oregon one day and said, would you and your husband come up and do a couples weekend? I said, hello? Hello? Do you know who you're talking to? And he said, yeah. I said, hey, Jim, come here. I said, they want us to go up to Oregon to a couples retreat. And he said, what? Do they know who they called? It was just so hysterical. And they did. And we agreed, of course, you never say no. And I said, what in the world are we going to do? Well, we had remembered a time that we drove from Oklahoma to Dallas. Jim Williams started a little conference somewhere down here. And we were his first couple of speakers. And he said he wanted us to work a little bit on a marriage workshop. And that's when we were just... we were such an Al-Anon couple. He was that, and I was. We were just an Al-Anon couple. And so we read this 10-step on the way over, and it was really good. And I remembered that, and I said, Jim, let's do that 10-step thing. And so we got out the 10-step, and we started studying it, and we started reading it to each other, and it was really awesome. Right before this, also, Jim and I were at this conference in Brownwood, the Lakeside Conference, and my sponsor came over Saturday afternoon, and she grabbed me and said, come with me. God grabbed Jim, said, come go with me. She took us over here. People could see us. You know, it was kind of off on the side, but she said, there's two things. And she said, there's one thing I really like about you two is you follow directions, and I'm giving you a direction. Both of you. Y'all have hugged everybody here except each other. Y'all have smiled at everybody at this conference except each other. You've treated everybody here very nice except each other. So this is what you're going to do. Every morning for the next 30 days, you're going to pray out loud for each other, and you're going to start now. She ducked that head, and when she ducked her head, I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I thought, crapola. It was very silent, and she was holding our hands, and I said, well, God bless Jim. And he said, well, God bless my wife. And she let us go. So the next, when we got home, I got up earlier than he did and had to leave, and I went over and woke him up. Jim, wake up. We got to pray. God bless Jim. God bless Lenoy. Bye, bye. Next day, Jim, wake up. We got to pray. God bless the night. God bless. Blah, blah. About fourth day, Jim, wake up. We got to pray. About the next week, honey, you can't come into God's presence and have that kind of attitude. Don't work. And then we got this call not too long after that, just a few months, maybe 6, 8, 9 months after that, we'd gotten this call. This is not about marriage, but it's about marriage. It's about relationships. It's about clean your life up. And it says, continue to pray, take personal inventory. When we wrong, promptly admitted it. And Jim and I used to use the funny promptly. You owe me a promptly. We just kind of, I owe you a promptly. And that was kind of it. It was kind of a joke, but it made everything lighter. You know, when really being the heavy-duty stuff, promptly, yeah, yeah, yeah. We would get into arguments about just about anything, and we had to learn what this meant. When, for instance, we were in Dallas, we were going to the Phoenix Group. A man called and asked Jim for directions to the Phoenix Group. I was listening to him, and he was giving him the wrong instructions. The man was never going to find it. He told him the streets, and he said, you go into this alley next to a liquor store, and you pull up in this parking lot, and the group is right over this bar. And he got off the phone and said, I was trying, Jim. He's, I said, Jim. And he got off. I said, Jim, you gave him the wrong directions. It's by a 7-Eleven, and it's right it's upstairs next to this big gym. They work out there. And he just, so we got there. We pulled into the alley. On this side was the liquor store. On this side of that alley was the 7-Eleven. I always noticed the 7-Eleven. I didn't notice the liquor store. The alcoholic noticed the liquor store. He never noticed the 7-Eleven. We pulled in the parking lot. I never knew that was a bar under there. He noticed the bar. He never knew there's a gym over there. He never noticed the gym. Now, we were both right, and we were both wrong, and we sat there dying laughing. And I said, promptly. He said, promptly. I mean, is that an incredible story? And that's a very true fight, and I couldn't wait to get there to show him how wrong he was, to prove it to him, and you know how we do.